The headlines. President Rouhani warns that Iranians will not forget the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and that they'll take revenge at an appropriate time. UN human rights experts say the U.S. president's pardon for four Blackwater contractors convicted of killing Iraqi civilians in 2007 is an affront to justice. And more than 3,900 Americans die of COVID-19 in the past 24 hours as total infections in the world's worst-hit country inch closer to 20 million. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says the nation will not forget the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani on the first anniversary of his martyrdom.
We will never forget the assassination of General Soleimani. It was a great tragedy. We will always be mourning for him, as well as for Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The Iranian nation and countries in the region will avenge their killing at an appropriate time.
Rouhani also slammed the U.S. for the, quote, savage assassination and denounced President Donald Trump for personally ordering the killing. The Iranian president hailed General Soleimani for his role in bringing peace and security to the region. He said Soleimani was a source of pride for Muslims as he brought dignity to regional countries and beyond. The chief of the Iranian armed forces says avenging the U.S. assassination of the country's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, will not expire. In a message on the first anniversary of Soleimani's assassination, Major General Mohammad Baghiri said the 3rd of January reminds us of a bitter incident in the history of the Islamic Republic. He said Soleimani was a national and Islamic hero and a great commander who helped strengthen the resistance against the U.S. hegemony and the Zionist regime. Baghiri stressed that Iran's revenge on the perpetrators of this terroristic crime and the withdrawal of U.S. forces from the region are unavoidable. The top general said that Iran's armed forces would double their motivation to follow the path of Soleimani. January the 3rd marks the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani. Mona Kandil has talked to a number of Palestinian experts on General Soleimani's death anniversary.
We consider Qasem Soleimani a martyr of Al-Quds because Iran has always supported the Palestinian resistance. We must concentrate on the spirit of resistance. Today, we resist illegal settlements as Israel continues to build here and there. We must stress on the real call of resistance. Our right is our weapon, and we will resist. We are the real owners of the land and the cause. No matter how long the night, it will end with a new dawn, and the dawn is coming.
Qasem Soleimani is a well-known leader, and his contributions are known in supporting Palestinians to get their freedom and to face the American-Israeli aggression. The U.S. supposed that by assassinating martyr Qasem Soleimani, Palestinians and their cause would dim. It was a cowardly operation, and Tehran's response was bold and immediate. I believe that the loss of Qasem Soleimani is a loss of a real national leader who worked hard to fight the American-Israeli oppression. He was always a strong defendant of Al-Quds. He supported Palestinians to end the Israeli occupation and its ongoing violence that is supported by the American administration. His memory remains as an inspiration for resistance fighters, and our people will always remain loyal to the sacrifices of this great leader.
Martyr Qasem Soleimani was assassinated in a cowardly operation. His assassination, done by the U.S. and Israel, is a crime, and those behind the attack must be held accountable. Today, we remember Martyr Soleimani with respect and pride. This martyr will always be remembered by all the people who are eager for freedom.
A group of UN rights experts have slammed the U.S. president's pardoning of American contractors implicated in Iraq killings, saying the move undermines international law.
These pardons violate U.S. obligations under international law and more broadly undermine humanitarian law and human rights at a global level. Pardoning the Blackwater contractors is an affront to justice and to the victims of the Nisour Square massacre and their families.
The group stressed that the Geneva Conventions oblige countries to hold war criminals accountable for their crimes even when they are acting as private security contractors. It added that by allowing private security contractors to, quote, operate with impunity, in armed conflict states would be emboldened to circumvent their obligations under humanitarian law. Last week, Trump pardoned four Blackwater contractors convicted of killing at least 14 Iraqi civilians in a 2007 massacre in Baghdad. The pardons triggered a wave of condemnations, including from many inside the U.S. Investigative journalist Tony Gossing believes Donald Trump has pardoned a bunch of thugs who took random shots at Iraqi civilians and killed them.
Well, in a way, this is worse than terrorism, isn't it? I mean, you've got basically a bunch of young men signed up to a private army. Now, what is a private army? If I wanted to start my own private army here in the UK, I'd probably come into some trouble. Except this is the vector that NATO and the Western governments are now using in order to excuse their own military from service. So when the situation gets tough politically in a particular part of the world, that what they'll do is they'll send in these private, basically mercenaries, to do these jobs. Now, I mean, if Trump was in any kind of wonder boy, like a lot of people seem to paint him out to be, you know, they people who are stuck in this either Biden or Trump, you know, dichotomy, which is really an illusion, you know, because the deep state is going to stay in power before and after Trump and Biden. I would like to see him pardoning somebody like Edward Snowden. I would like to see him pardoning somebody like Chelsea Manning or Julian Assange. We're all very much wanting that here in the UK, waiting, listening. Trump, who are you? You know, are you? He's got nothing to lose by doing these things. He would get an enormous cachet around the world, but he doesn't do that. He pardons a bunch of basically thugs, and that's all these people were. They weren't even very proficient terrorists. They were just taking random shots for their own amusement, killing people in the streets in Iraq.
The UAE-backed Southern Transitional Council has accused Qatar and Turkey of being behind the explosions that targeted Yemen's Aden airport and killed dozens. This after videos went viral on social media showing missiles launched from inside the Green City in Aden. Abdul Latif Al Washali reports from Sana'a.
After dozens of civilians, including Ghadi's government officials, were killed and injured in the attack on Aden Airport, the deputy head of the Emirati-backed Southern Transitional Council, Hani bin Baraik, accused Qatar and Turkey of being behind it, ruling out that Sana'a was involved in it.
It's clear who's behind this latest attack in Aden Airport is the one who benefit the most from this attack, and is United Arab Emirates. United Arab Emirates and its forces in Aden, because United Arab Emirates doesn't want to be there a government which can actually express the term Yemen, or which can actually be in Aden. That's why United Arab Emirates, they want south of Yemen to be divided, all Yemen to be divided, so the United Arab Emirates can control Bab al-Mandab and the Bab al-Mandab Strait, and as well control Socotra Island. And
videos that went viral on social media showed that the missiles were launched from inside the Green City in Aden, which made observers accuse the SAC of seeking to push back Hadi's government to Riyadh hotels and fail the Riyadh agreement. The deputy head of SAC had preempted the arrival of the new Hadi government with a campaign to raise the flags of South Yemen in private and public facilities, including Aden International Airport, and he also warned members of the Hadi government not to talk about Yemeni unity, which confirms the continuing tension between the two parties to the conflict in southern Yemen.
There's no place for Hadi and his government in Aden. This is the message that the attack on the airport carried, meaning that Aden will continue to suffer under the rule of the militias of the UAE-backed STC. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
On this news review, the long-awaited departure of the United Kingdom from the European Union will officially take effect at 2300 GMT. The British Queen has already signed a post-Brexit deal with the EU after Parliament approved it in the early hours of Thursday, allowing the country to avoid a no-deal divorce scenario. Prime Minister Boris Johnson said the destiny of the country now resides firmly in the hands of Britons. He described the UK's departure from the bloc as a new beginning, while keeping the EU as its biggest ally, the opposition Labour Party, A fierce opponent of Brexit said it would now push for greater prosperity, fairness, and opportunity, with the country forging a new path in the world. Brexit has dominated British politics since the country's narrow vote to leave the bloc in June 2016, opening deep political and social issues. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent, Robert Carter, joining us from the British capital, London. Also joining us from London, we have Professor of Binary Economics, Mr. Rodney Shakespeare. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Robert Carter in London. Robert, a sigh of relief, I guess, as the disastrous no-deal Brexit scenario has been averted. What's in store now for Britain?
Well, I think that that's a fair comment to make. I think that the majority of people in this country are quite sick and tired of Brexit. We've reached a stage now where I think the majority of people, particularly in England, just wanted to get it done one way or the other, even if that meant a no-deal scenario. But ultimately, having a deal arguably is better. I think it was a minority opinion that a no-deal was the best move for the UK economy. But going forward, it's not going to be easy from this point onwards. There are a lot of new rule and law changes which are going to be brought into effect, and we still don't have a clear picture on exactly how every new type of scenario is going to work. There was a lot of questions raised in the Commons ahead of the vote about the situation along the borders with Northern Ireland, which is of course separated from mainland UK, and also other areas like Gibraltar, a territory located down by Spain. How is their border relationship going to be? Gibraltar heavily dependent on its trade between mainland Spain and its little coastal position. So these types of questions still need to be answered. Also, it is speculated that in the new year, when new border control regulations come into place between the UK and mainland Europe, there could be a return of those huge lorry queues that we saw in Dover before. Previously, it was because of the COVID-19 lockdown, but this time there'll be new documents, new paperwork that need to be filled in by the drivers, and it's believed that many of the drivers are simply going to show up on January the 1st, January the 2nd, and they just won't have the correct paperwork, and this could cause a backlog, and it's going to take a lot of time once again to get through all of those new issues. So yes, the post-Brexit trade deal has been agreed, but there's still a lot of details that need to be finalized, and it's believed that there will be a bit of chaotic scenes to be seen going through in 2021.
Rodney Shakespeare, what will the future relationship between the UK and the EU look like? Are there any more hurdles left now?
The relationship will be fraught, and there are many hurdles. Look, the UK is going into fantasy land. This idea that we can improve the situation by breaking away from Europe. Now, we haven't broken away completely, but what has happened? We've made the situation worse. We will have a continued lower standard of living at about 2% per year or more for years and years. We will have countless form filling, and any attempt to, as it were, lower our standards will be met by Europe putting on the tariffs and quotas. We're going to get very little, in fact, probably get nothing out of this. We've just weakened our position, and we're getting less than what we had before. And there are whole areas which are not even decided. Goodness me, services are 80% of the UK economy. And the services are the great undecided aspect of this situation. So I'm sorry, but this is not good news. It is not really, well, it is a new start in one sense, and it's a new start into something which is hazy, illusory, a fantasy land, and basically based on the idea of the British Empire that the UK will be in a position to shove everybody else around. The opposite is true. They'll shove us around.
So, Mr. Shakespeare, is the UK better off without the EU, or is it vice versa?
The the UK is what now going to be worse off than what it was before. It has weakened its position, and it's sheer illusion to think that we can get out of this and in some way magically go round and recreate the British Empire, in which we're stronger an economy. You have to cooperate. All this sovereignty stuff is an illusion. In real life, you cooperate with others all the time, and only spoilt brats think there's such a thing as complete and absolute sovereignty, where you can go around and shove everybody around all the time and not cooperate. You get that sort of thing from Donald Trump and from the hardline Brexiteers who are behind this.
Robert, do you agree with what Professor Shakespeare has just said, that the UK is basically not better off not being a member of the EU? Also, we do recall there are a lot of whispers of probably this leading up to the breaking up of the UK as well.
Yes, in fact, I would say that, you know, it's still speculated as to how well the UK could do outside of the EU with this European Union, a trade, post-Brexit trade agreement that's been agreed. We'll have to wait and see how that develops. But the point you mentioned about the potential breakup of the UK, I think, is a very serious possibility. You may remember that I have been to Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland for Press TV over the past couple of years, and I've witnessed the huge growth in momentum for the independence movements in Wales and Scotland. It's a massive movement which has been re-energized following Brexit, and again, the debate surrounding Irish reunification has also been brought back into the forefront of political discourse in Northern Ireland. And again, I think that there is a real possibility that could be the next big battle that Westminster politicians face, is this huge momentum for independence. I think the Scottish independence movement has the most potential to succeed, if you like, although Westminster is doing its utmost to stop another referendum on Scottish independence taking place at all. It is a very powerful movement, and it's growing in all of the countries of the kingdom except for England. So that in itself, I've seen the evidence of how forceful that movement can become. And if it succeeds in any way, shape or form, then yes, the UK could be broken up and it could be a much smaller international entity. And I would say that Brexit played a major role in that. But let's wait and see how it develops.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Robert Carter, a correspondent, joining us from London. Also, thanks to Professor Rodney Shakespeare, also joining us from the British capital. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. The United States has registered a record high of more than 3,900 daily deaths from the coronavirus pandemic. That's according to data compiled by Johns Hopkins University. The latest figure brings the country's overall death toll from the virus to nearly 342,000. Total infections also rise by nearly 190,000 to over 19.7 million. The U.S. is the world's worst-hit country by the pandemic in terms of both infections and deaths. Health officials have warned that the country is yet to witness the worst, with the death toll rising at an alarming rate in winter months and after New Year's holidays. December has already dethroned April as the nation's deadliest month of COVID-19. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're going to be discussing the documentary Drone, directed by award-winning Norwegian filmmaker Tonya Hessen-Schei. And joining me in the studio, we have Tim Roby, who is a film critic for the Daily Telegraph and Radio 4's film programme, and Dan Blaisbrook, who's a journalist, political analyst, and author of the book Divide and Ruin, The West's Imperial Strategy in an Age of Crisis. Now, Drone is about the ultimate weapon in the war on terror. Through a mixture of original interviews, archive material, and simulations, Schei reveals crucial information about the workings of the covert CIA drone war, which the film argues has revolutionized killing, has turned war into a video game, and has had a devastating impact on human life in places such as Pakistan.
Imagine killing more than 1,500 enemies in war without ever stepping foot on the battlefield.
We are at war with an organization that would kill as many Americans as they could if we did not stop them first.
The drones have changed everything. It's the defining weapon of the war on terror.
It's never been easier for an American president to carry out a killing operation at the ends of the earth.
We are safer because of our efforts. These strikes have saved lives.
I didn't really understand what it meant to kill at first. We sat in a box. We were the ultimate peeping toms.
You never know who you're killing because you never actually see a face.
1,626 people were killed in the operations that I took part of.
How many of them do you think were innocent?
I'm the only one that really is vocal about it. It just blows my mind.
War is an unbelievably profitable business.
The military has invested in video games as recruiting tools.
How do we find our 18X pilots? How do we identify these people early?
I had no idea what I was in for. I wasn't even 20 years old at that point.
Dozens of highly skilled Al-Qaeda operatives have been taken off the battlefield.
The United States is violating one of the most fundamental rights of all, the right to life.
The truth is, the vast majority of people have no earthly idea what's happening here.
It is not justifiable killing unarmed, innocent civilians.
As a former RPA drone operator, I have concerns about how the drone community operates.
The U.S. has to explain what went wrong.
Drones have not caused a huge number of civilian casualties.
We've seen them make mistakes by the hundreds.
The rescuers were coming, and the CIA was coming back and bombing again.
I believe the United States of America must remain a standard bearer in the conduct of war.
It's just point and click.
We'll be right back.
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming. I must say this documentary really shook me. It was incredibly chilling, extremely informative, and raises a lot of serious questions about the morality of drone warfare. And Tim, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I think it's really good. It's a very kind of polished presentation of a lot of the arguments around drone warfare, which manages to cram a lot into quite a brief running time. In fact, it's only about an hour and 15 minutes long. But I particularly valued the range of perspectives in it, because you get an awful lot of them. You get the kind of military perspective from a kind of critiquing position. You get the industrial perspective from a kind of constructor. You get the perspective of an actual drone operator. You get the ground level perspective of victims, particularly in Waziristan, where the CIA has been kind of most guilty of kind of really pushing the drone operation to its limit. And yes, the survivors and the families of victims are especially moving in that respect. And the overall kind of mosaic that's built up is quite damning, I think, and well put together in the edit.
I was going to say, there's a whole range of different people interviewed in this documentary that makes it really rich. And Dan, as someone who's familiar on this subject of drone warfare, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I thought it was very good, and it really highlighted how what was once the kind of ultimate dystopian fantasy of the future, basically people being hunted by robots, is now a reality in places like Waziristan. And it really shows the juxtaposition between, as we saw there, the operatives who are, as far as they're concerned, playing a video game in the US and Virginia or wherever it is, and then the lives of people in Waziristan. And you know, this juxtaposition between this high, super high levels of technology, the most kind of advanced technology available to mankind, being visited upon one of the most underdeveloped regions on the planet. After seeing the film, I looked up some of the human development statistics for Waziristan. Mm-hmm. And it's shocking, less than 20% of the houses there have running water. More than a third lack electricity. There's one doctor per 1,000. Infant mortality is nearly 1 in 10. And yet the pretty much the only technology the rich world decides to send to these places is this industrial killing machine. And so that juxtaposition was really brought home. And you also saw the juxtaposition between the operatives who are often basically recruited literally as children and barely children through the video game industry, which they point out has
deep. Actually, I want to talk about the video game industry a bit later on. It's a good point. But I just want to briefly talk now, just before we go to our next clip, about the nature of drones. So it's a quick and easy death. Could you explain exactly how they work?
Well, they're a combination of the three things, I suppose, aren't they? A camera, an airplane, and a missile. Mm-hmm. So the operative is controlling them remotely. There's no pilot on board, and they find their target, which, as they said, they don't actually see in great depth because the drones are very high. They can't see their faces, and this is part of what the film brings out very well as well, is the depersonalization of killing to make it easier to kill. As mentioned on the trailer, you never see their faces, and it shows later in the film about how they try to show the humanity to the operatives of the people they're killing by actually.
And that's actually a good point, because it leads us right to our next clip. Actually,
right.
We're going to see Brandon Wright now, who's a former drone operator.
I watched this man bleed out. The missile had taken him off one of his legs, right above the knee, and I watched him bleed out of his femoral artery. Rolling on the ground, and I imagined his last moments. I didn't know what to feel. I just knew that I had ended something that I had no right to end. But I swore an oath, did what I was supposed to do. I followed through with it. It was like my image of myself was cracking and breaking apart. And the safety observer laughs, and he slaps me on the back, and he says, "You should have seen how you jumped when I said splash." And he's laughing like it's the biggest joke in the world.
That was truly harrowing and sadistic, that. I mean, so that was Brandon Bryant, a former drone operator turned American whistleblower. Now, Tim, we can tell from the documentary, even though he's done some terrible things, he comes across as genuinely remorseful, and you can't help but feel sorry for him. Do you think this was an intentional part on behalf of the filmmaker?
Yeah, very much so. He's one of the most sympathetic interviewees, and his testimony is really quite powerful. It helps that he's so photogenic. His sort of, if you like, his turning, the change of his mind and opinion about it reminded me of the way that it's been dramatized for feature films, actually. And there's a film called Good Kill with Ethan Hawke playing a very similar figure who is an operator who really kind of suffers this sudden crisis of conscience. And I think it's very well put across, actually. And he's very articulate at it in his kind of quiet way. And it's important that people like him are stepping forward to make the point, in fact, that, you know, the real cost morally is to them, not to their superiors, not to the people telling them what to do, but to the actual people clicking the button, if you like. And the idea of being kind of instructed, for instance, to perform one of the so-called double tap strikes, where, you know, you drop a bomb, and then people come in to try and help the wounded and the victims, and drop another bomb in the same site. The idea of being the person who's actually having to physically click the button, send in death to a bunch of completely innocent civilians who are just simply on the scene to help, would really haunt you for the rest of your life, I think. And that's the feeling we get from this guy.
Yeah, we get that sense of the psychological impact it has on the former drone operators. And Dan, in the documentary, it seems as though they were duped into the job. You could tell he was conflicted. And can you explain more on that?
Well, yeah, he talks about one. In fact, it's interesting you say about him kind of turning, but in fact, he says right from the start, before he pressed the button on anyone, about having this feeling like he didn't think he'd be able to kill anyone. And he tells his superior, and the superior tells him, well, sorry, but you signed the oath, you have to.
And so surely it must be okay then.
Right. Well,
the cognitive dissonance there.
Exactly. Partly it must be okay, but I think more than that, he doesn't see a way out. And he talks about not being allowed to see a therapist because that break it induces security clearance. Goes to see a chaplain. The chaplain says it's part of God's plan. Basically, it's fine. So he's in doubt about it from the start. But it really shows, like I was saying before, they're kind of recruited as children playing video games, and then they literally start doing it still as teenagers. Often, the other drone operative there. The interview started when he was 19, I think. I'm not sure when this guy started, but it really shows, I think, the kind of institutionalized child abuse, really, on both in both the U.S. and Waziristan. They're killing children. They've targeted 16-year-olds before. Maybe they've targeted younger children. Way younger children have been killed as innocent bystanders. But the children in the U.S. are there recruiting and getting to do this stuff. Are permanently damaged. Well, they're permanently damaged if they have any empathy. But obviously, part of drone warfare is to try and get rid of empathy on the side of the operatives as well.
I think it desensitizes them in a lot of sense as well. And I think, Tim, one of the major issues also in this documentary is the video game industry and its relationship with the military. Could you explain to us a bit more about that in the film?
Yeah, this is a significant kind of subplot, if you like. And they talk about how, instead of recruiting meatheads these days, there's one person interviewed who says that, in fact, they're now looking for the geeks. You know, basically, the kids who are really good at, you know, these war games, the Tom Clancy Ghost Recon-type war games. There's this sort of weird conference that you can see set up where they're all kind of testing out these games. And the military is sort of crawling around trying to find who the most skillful players are, because that's going to be the next generation of operators and recruits. It's not a new thing for the military to exploit extremely young soldiers. I mean, look at Vietnam, look at the ages of kids being sent into Vietnam, for instance. But it's certainly a new technology that's enabling it to happen from a whole world away, and to happen in a way that is very veiled and controlled, so that the moral question is removed from the equation.
Mm-hmm. So then it's essentially glamorizing and normalizing warfare in the form of video games. It's a really fascinating subject.
War is an unbelievably profitable business. The development of robotic warfare, and particularly drones, is having a huge impact on the trade in arms generally, because it's causing the big defense contractors to rethink their business models and how they're going to sell enough drones to be able to make the sorts of profits that they're making on the big ticket, very expensive items, aircraft carriers, jet fighters, etc. So I think what that is going to do is ensure that we see produced far more drones than even your very hawkish security analyst would think that the world needs. And these companies are huge. And you only have a few of them in every country, closely linked to their governments.
funny to think that, which the documentary mentions, that drones were originally invented to help fishermen find tuna fish. And you wouldn't think that, but of course that wasn't profitable, so they weaponized them. So Tim, what are your thoughts on this? Is this a worrisome endeavor, the prospect of drones and as business?
Well, absolutely. I mean, as any kind of business concern tied to warfare would disturb you, this does. I think for me the single most disturbing implication of the film is the idea that terrorism is providing an excuse for the US military to develop this technology someone uses the phrase the terrorist industrial complex. The idea that, you know, if they're out there, we've got to keep doing this stuff, we've got to keep building it, we've got to keep getting better and better at killing people. And warfare becomes a permanent state rather than one that you declare and then you declare over. It becomes a permanent state because at any point you can click and send in death to anywhere in the world. That is extremely disturbing, I think, and the film brings it up quite smartly. I could have watched another whole film on that topic, actually, that much broader topic.
And what were your thoughts on the advancement of military technology and drones as a business?
Yeah, it's very worrying, and it's I agree with Tim that it's setting the stage for permanent war, not just permanent war, but also war without geographical boundaries. The whole world is a battlefield in the global war on terror. So they opened, I think, right at the start of the film, they say, well, US is not at war with Pakistan, mm-hmm. and yet it's sending out these bomber planes.
I wanted to actually ask you, actually, because it does mention that, but why is the US at war with Pakistan then?
Well, I mean, I think what is missing from the film, this isn't necessarily a criticism, because I don't think it's not trying necessarily to explain the politics of it so much as present just a picture of what's happening.
Presenting the facts, right.
Right, but the politics are slightly absent, and I think the politics of it are that so it comes across very disturbing, but at the same time, I think we should be aware that really this is not a sign of US omnipotence. Far from it, it's actually a sign of desperation, because the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were so costly in terms of blood and treasure, and blood to their own side, that basically Colin Powell said in 2006 the US Army is broken. It meant the resistance to those wars meant they could not continue, they could basically rule out the prospect of any similar mass occupation by US forces. So what we've seen as a response to that is this new type of warfare, which has got two elements. Part of it is drone warfare, and part of it is proxy wars, where you're recruiting local militia to basically do the fighting in place of US soldiers. Mm-hmm. So that's part of what's driving it, I think. I don't think it's all about the profits of the military and so on. It's
Tim,
strategic.
Would you have liked to see that in the film? Thanks, Dan, for the explanation. But would you have liked to see more context?
Especially about Waziristan, I think, because it's such a sort of strange theatre for them to have encroached into, and the attacks there are much more prolific than anywhere else. Mm. So we see the kind of suffering, but we don't have any sense of the motive. It's very peculiar. And that was a problem for me. I mean, a lot of the kind of deaths and the damage there were obviously collateral, and there are civilian deaths, no matter how much, you know, the US government would like to not deny that those are happening in large quantities. And there's an interesting kind of contradiction in terms of the technology developing, I think, because the more sophisticated and targeted it can become, with any luck, you would find fewer of those civilian casualties. So there's this peculiar thing. The film does raise that point slightly, and I found that an interesting kind of counter argument, if you like. Mm-hmm. I thought it was an interesting wrinkle in the thesis, because yes, the more targeted they get, if drone warfare is going to be allowed to remain legal, well, that is in fact preferable than just the kind of blanket bombing approach.
Well, I think that's slightly
right. Apology there, gentlemen. Sorry, we'll continue this in the next part of the discussion, as we're going to fast forward towards the end of the film now.
The United States has become a national security state whose raison d'etre is war. We've created a terrorist industrial complex that is self-perpetuating, and now searching for the reason for this constant state of war, terrorism is the perfect case for us. We can do this forever.
It just feels like we're going through like a bad science fiction novel. The
If we dehumanize war, if we take the human aspect out of it, what's to stop us from just sending a bunch of automaton robots into another country and let them wipe out the entire population? People were writing about this in like the early 1900s. What could happen? And we're watching it happen.
Tim, would you agree with that statement? Is that one of the main messages that this film leaves you with?
Yeah, the desensitization of violence and warfare is, again, one of the most unsettling aspects of this. And the idea that you're not in combat face-to-face, you're in combat halfway around the globe. Yes, I do think that the attempts to bring a kind of moral or moral understanding to those involved, and this is, they do things like trying to put big posters of children's faces over the top of buildings in Waziristan, so that the operators, you know, with the drone cameras, will have to see their target before they press the button, will have to make that decision. But you suspect that the US military will still find people that they can kind of bully into pressing the button, and that's the really disturbing thing. Mm-hmm. And the kind of psychological cost on those soldiers, if you like, must be extraordinary. And how they are, the legality of it is another question. And another very interesting point raised by a legal professor at the end is, you know, even if through some kind of loophole the CIA is allowing, is kind of making the argument that this is in fact legal war, the question is, should it be? The question is, do we want that to be declared legal? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not enough to say, yes, this is technically legal. You have to sort of say, well, should it be?
Well, Dan, sorry. Sorry, did you, were you saying
yeah,
the same
word?
Dan, would you agree? But I mean, President Obama, though, says that drones saves lives and kills lots of terrorists in one go. How accurate is that claim?
Well, I'd say two things. It's not accurate. We know there have been hundreds of. I think why I was going to say is a red herring a little bit to say that there's to make this distinction between who's targeted and who's the bystander. I mean, on the one hand, there have been huge numbers of bystanders killed. They're not that targeted. They had footage from one drone strike that killed 44 people. I've read a study that suggests 8% only of the victims of drone strikes have been actual known al-Qaeda operatives. But I think even that making that distinction is false. The most interesting point I thought made by anyone on the film was a Pakistani lawyer, Shahzad Akbar, who says, Westerners always ask me the same thing. How many civilians have been killed in these strikes? He said, my answer is they're all civilians. He says, no one's ever proved that they're militants. They've never been on trial. There's been no evidence presented. And I think this really illustrates what lies behind, as you say, they'll always find people willing to press the button. Now, why is that? What's driving this more than any military-industrial complex is racism. It really shows the relevance, I think, of Frantz Fanon's concept of a zone of non-being. Basically, since the conquest of the Americas, the Europeans have treated non-Europeans as less than human. And places like Waziristan, you don't have to respect the rule of law, you don't have to respect due process. And as the lawyer says, people in Waziristan seem to be treated guilty until proven innocent.
And that is a powerful message that it leaves you, that you can take that interpretation. But for Tim, what message does this documentary leaving you with in 30 seconds or so?
Yeah, it's this kind of the lack of geographical boundaries and the kind of the idea of being watched, you know, if you are declared an enemy of the US government, the state of total paranoia that you would live in, knowing that these things are flying over your heads, it makes that very clear. There's a very good image as well of the Waziristan children with catapults trying to shoot up into the sky. It was a brilliant David versus Goliath image of their impotence in the face of this really all-pervasive threat.
Yeah, and how helpless they are. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام الصيام والحج تسكين القلوب.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "The fast and the obligatory pilgrimage, Hajj, pacify the heart."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in the historical texts a very profound, a very long, but a very interesting conversation between a student and a faithful companion by the name of Jabir bin Yazid al-Jawfi, and with the Imam of the time, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace be upon him. Now, in this conversation, in this dialogue, we find that the student and the teacher exchange some words, and Imam al-Baqir tells Jabir some very golden pieces of advice, some very profound pieces of spiritual and moral wisdom. Now, it's not possible to be able to talk about this whole conversation between the two in just one session, but we have decided to pick out bits and pieces. At one place, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says to Jabir, "There is no reason or logic like opposing desire, and there is no fear like the fear which is protective." Allahu Akbar. Truly, these short statements in this conversation that Imam al-Baqir has are so profound and deep with meaning. For example, he says that the best logic, the best reason, the best common sense, the best power is opposing one's desires. Of course, now this is keeping in mind that desires are those things which pull us towards our own selves. And this pulling us towards our own selves makes us egotistical, it makes us selfish, it makes us self-centered. So here, the logical thing, the most reasonable thing to do is to oppose these desires. And then the next part is that the protective fear, the fear which protects a person, is the best kind of fear. Now, here we're talking about fearing things like what? Fearing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, fearing disobeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so this fear of disobeying God, it protects us from committing sins and doing wrong things. So there is no reason, like there is no logic, like opposing desire, and there is no fear, like the fear which is protective. Beautiful words exchanged in this dialogue between Jabir al-Jawfi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
Also, it was the time when Imam alayhi salam trained jurists or qadhi. In other places, you find there are qadhis. And these qadhis, they will give fatwa, they will judge between people, divorce, marriages, issues, and so on and so forth. Imam alayhi salam trained students in order for them to occupy these ranks. Also, he trained juris scholars, those scholars who will be able to deduct law from their sources easily. Also, Imam alayhi salam, he stood firm against muqawamati ijtihadi ra'i. He stood against ijtihad ar-ra'i when people would come and say, according to the way I see it, my opinion is this on the basis of my understanding, which is not according to the jurisprudential approach. Someone would say, according to the way I see it, this thing is halal, this thing is haram. And you can see the trend even nowadays. We have some people who would say, well, according to my reading of the Holy Quran and the tafsir, if you look at this English translation and that, you put them together, this is my opinion on this particular issue. Islam is not like that. We have to refer to the scholars in order for us to understand the masail, jurisprudential issues well. We cannot just pick and choose or do qiyas the way other scholars, the way they do. Of those who are not followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Imam alayhi salam stood against falsafa al-fasida, philosophy which was not compatible with Islamic teachings. He taught his students to go against that particular philosophy. And there was a group of people who are known as Zanadiqa. Zanadiqa were people who call themselves Muslims. Their names are Islamic. But unfortunately, their belief was like a kafir, and they would mingle with Muslims, and they would say issues. You wonder sometimes when you hear their opinions, and you just say, Astaghfirullah, Astaghfirullah. Imam alayhi salam trained the students to be against these particular people.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.